Thank you very much, Roger, and thank you for organising what I hope is going to be a very interesting and stimulating panel. And it's a great opportunity because we're all kind of here by chance a little bit, and we thought, well, we can reconvene part of the Resilience Academy in Washington, D.C., which is very exciting. So I'm going to speak very, very briefly about the paper that we have been working on at the Academy, one of the many papers, in fact, but this is the framing paper, which is co-authored by the people here and the people in the Academy, and is just about to be published. I think it's published online now in Nature Climate Change. So it's a paper that we're hoping will reach quite a wide audience because we think it's important. And it's based on the discussions that we've been having at these two Resilience Academy events, the first in Bangladesh last year and then the follow-up in Germany earlier this year. And what this paper is about linking the concept of resilience, which has now become a very well-known and useful concept, but linking it more closely with the idea of livelihoods on the one hand and the idea of rights on the other. So the resilience concept has become very popular, but we think that it requires greater attention to be paid to the relationship and the issue of human livelihoods if it's to address the limits to reactive adaptation strategies and also address the development needs of the planet's poorest and most vulnerable people. This is really the theme of the paper. And although the concept of resilience is increasingly informing research and policy, it's been transferred from ecological theory and thinking into social and political systems, which we fear has led to quite a weak engagement with the normative, the political, the social dimensions of climate change adaptation. And that's really what we're trying to get at. So for example, one problem of the resilience idea is that it's a metaphor which implies a return to a previously existing state or condition before a shock, which of course is an important idea, but it also makes it conservative because for people who are the most vulnerable and the poorest, they don't want to build, back to that previous state. They want to build back better. And I think that idea of building back better has gained quite a lot of ground now, and it's definitely one that people are engaging with. But we still wanted to go a little bit further than that. And this is where we started to make connections between livelihoods and rights and resilience. So what we argue is that if we bring a livelihoods perspective into resilience ideas and thinking, this will help to place a greater emphasis on human needs and their agency, on empowerment and on human rights. And in putting livelihoods systems in the context of wider transformational changes at the policy level. So many of you probably have come across this concept of livelihoods, and in particular the Sustainable Livelihoods Framework, which has been around as a set of ideas within the development policy world now for a couple of decades nearly. And the Sustainable Livelihoods Framework is this idea that if we're looking at changes to the position of the most vulnerable households, it makes a lot of sense to start with a household perspective and to look at the various types of resources that households are already using to try and improve their position or to maintain their position or to reduce their vulnerability and to strengthen their livelihoods strategies. And what this framework does is it looks at both the tangible and the non-tangible resources that households draw upon in trying to undertake and maintain their livelihoods. And it also provides a way of linking the micro and the macro. It looks at both the small-scale aspects of how households work and how they go about trying to build and maintain and strengthen their livelihoods, but it also looks at the different forces which both act upon them at the institutional level, but which also they seek to engage with or to influence or to change. So it links households and wider institutions, and it links households with wider power dynamics. So in this paper, which is a very short paper, and it's intended to be short because it's trying to be readable and accessible to everybody, and I'm going to be very brief as well. I'm going to stop talking in a minute. But there's a couple of very brief examples that we give in the paper. One of them I think Robin will probably talk about later on this afternoon. But to illustrate what I'm talking about, there's a very small example we give from Bangladesh, from an NGO called ActionAid, which undertakes a kind of community-level research approach to local-level adaptation, which it calls people's research. And it basically works at community level to try and build the capacity of rural communities to both understand the changes that are associated with climate change, how those changes impact on that community, to research the history of those changes through their own oral histories, through their own memories of different kinds of harvests and changes and water access and drought and all of those kinds of things. So it works with people to build, for example, climate change calendars, seasonal change measurement, looking at things like sort of awareness around the climate change issue. And it's leading to all kinds of small-scale innovations, which are very important, things like new cropping patterns, assisting people with different water management techniques, looking at a needs-based strengthening of livelihoods, in other words, rather than the kind of top-down approaches which have characterized a lot of the policy efforts in Bangladesh over the last few decades. One very well-known one about 20 years ago, which involved a lot of international money and attention and didn't really go very far at all, was something called the Flood Action Plan, which did very little to change the problem of flood control in Bangladesh. And I and many other people are very anxious that the new interest in climate change and adaptation and the resources that are going into it, that we don't fall into that same top-down trap again. So this is an example of how, certainly at the level of one NGO and its approach to community-level adaptation work, which of course is also supported by work at the institutional level in terms of advocacy, campaigning both nationally and internationally to try to secure influence in the wider policy processes that also impact down onto this very one, this one particular community location. So when we think about livelihoods, we think about, people's income. We think about maybe if they're rural people, we think about the land that they may own or have access to and the crops that they grow, the material aspects of that. But a livelihood system is much broader than that. It looks at all the tangible and non-tangible resources which would go into maintaining livelihoods. But it also looks at livelihoods as more than just material things. It looks at human development issues. It looks at education. It looks at, politics and rights and, quality of life and well-being and the spiritual dimensions of a livelihood. I mean, all of these things, much, much broader than the more economistic views of what a livelihood might be.